From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Did you know that Evansville was the most productive city of its size for war goods and materials from December 7, 1941, Pearl Harbor Day, until VJ Day, Victory over Japan, September 2, 1945? That fact is worthy of a museum, the Evansville Wartime Museum. My guests are Jeff Dyg, a board member of the museum, and World War II veteran Alan Sanderson, who piloted a P-47 Thunderbolt made in Evansville. Gentlemen, welcome. Alan, of course, I'm very anxious to hear what it was like to fly the P-47, especially in combat. But first, let's start with you, Jeff. Kind of give us the basics of the museum. When did it open? Where is it located?
Okay, we just celebrated our one-year anniversary. We opened about a year ago on Memorial Day weekend, and we're having great success. We've grown leaps and bounds. We're actually just off Highway 41. If you go north on Highway 41 and turn right on Petersburg Road at the Dairy Queen.
That's a good landmark.
That's a good landmark. We can you can go as far as you can, and we're the last hangar on the right-hand side. We're actually in a hangar.
So what's the most favorite attraction at the museum? What do people really like to see there?
Alan Sanderson. that's our most...
Well, he's not in a case or anything like that.
No,
he's
antique.
Well, but you do have an airplane in the hangar, of course.
We've got different exhibits that come and go, which makes it nice because it keeps the museum fresh. And we've had a couple of planes in there, an AT-6 Texan trainer and a Stearman biplane. We've got a World War II ambulance. We've got a 1939 Plymouth that was actually what Chrysler made before they started making bullets. We've actually got a real engine, a Pratt & Whitney 2,000 horsepower engine that would have been used to power the P-47s. So just a lot of great artifacts and stories that go with those that make it interesting.
Now, you said the museum is on airport property. Now, it's just across the runway is where the P-47 warplanes were built at Republic Aviation, which later became the Whirlpool plant. Now, Alan Sanderson is here, World War II veteran. Now, Alan, you flew these planes in combat both in Italy and France, and they were nicknamed the Jug. Is that right?
That's right.
The Jug for Juggernaut?
No, if you looked at the P-47, it just had the shape, if you're hanging up by the tail, it looked like a jug.
Now, these were powerful aircraft. I mean, they had big engines and a lot of armament.
Yeah, they had a 2,000 horsepower Pratt Whitney engine, and it had 18 cylinders, 9 cylinders behind 9 cylinders. It was a very powerful airplane for its time in 1942. At 40,000 feet, it would go 432 miles an hour. And in 1942, that was pretty fast.
And it had firepower, too.
Yes, and had 8 50 caliber machine guns, 4 on each wing. It could carry a 1,000-pound bomb. It could carry 2 500-pound bombs. And at one time, they even put rockets on each wing.
Wow. Now, that is a lot of power. Now, Jeff, the Evansville Wartime Museum, of course, highlights the incredible productivity of local industry during the war years. Now, these local firms, which had been making automobiles, refrigerators, other peacetime products, had to quickly retool to make the items needed to win the war.
That's correct. Actually, unemployment was a problem before the war for the city of Evansville. We employed like 13,000 people. And then at the peak during the war, we had built it up to 90,000 people. With that tremendous increase in employment level, also came problems with where does everybody sleep, you know, where are they going to stay, and different things like that. The African-American and the women workforce, without them, it wouldn't have happened. They were tremendous. That was the only way that the production was going to be able to get there.
That's right, because, of course, the men were going off to war and being recruited. Now, thousands were, like you said, recruited into the workforce, and thousands more had to line up to enlist in the military. So, Alan, when did you enlist?
Well, I enlisted in May of 42. Pearl Harbor, of course, was December before that. And like everybody else, I stood in line to enlist. Everybody was gung-ho to get in the service and get the war over.
Mm-hmm. Now, why did you choose the Air Corps?
Something I'd always been interested in. Every time there was an air show at the nearby airport, well, I always went, and I always thought it'd be great to fly, so that was my number one purpose.
Now, where did you grow up, Alan?
In Roanoke, Virginia.
Not too far from the Kitty Hawk area,
well,
birthplace
a little bit north of
flight.
Of that.
Well, that was kind of in your blood, I guess, area. So what was your training like, Alan?
Training was great. We started off with just basic training like all soldiers get. And then we went into pre-flight school and learned all the everything about instruments, navigation, and so forth. Then we went into flying school. We had three phases, primary, basic, and then advanced. Then we graduated, got our wings, and were considered a pilot. And from then on, it was all combat aircraft.
Now, where did you receive your training? What was that, a fort?
In the southeast. I was in Alabama and Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you have a choice of what type of plane you like to fly, or did they just give you a plane and go for it?
No, when we got out of flying school and were commissioned a lieutenant in the service and got our wings, they sent us to Fort Myers, Florida, and we were introduced to the P-47 there.
Mm-hmm. Now, my guests are Alan Sanderson, a World War II veteran who flew the P-47 on more than, I think, 100 combat missions, and Jeff Dieg, who is helping tell the story of the Evansville Wartime Museum. Now, coming up, we're going to find out from Alan what it was like to actually squeeze into the cockpit of a P-47, and we'll also learn more about the everyday life in Evansville during the war years, the train traffic, the USO, the Red Cross canteens, and the bomb that became a girl's doll? Well, Jeff's going to explain that. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Evansville Regional Airport. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James, and my guests are Jeff Dieg with the Evansville Wartime Museum and World War II veteran Alan Sanderson, who flew a P-47 made right here in Evansville. Now, Jeff, Evansville, of course, a bustling place during World War II. Lots of servicemen and women coming through town, along with all the war plant workers in the city. The biggest employer was the Evansville Shipyard, making those LSTs.
Yes, sir. Matter of fact, if you haven't seen the LST 325 Museum, you've got to see that. They're a great partner of ours, and they're part of our story. The four basic areas that we try and emphasize, of course, all the Tier 1 suppliers that supply these industries, but the shipyard where they made the LSTs, and Republic Aviation that made the P-47s, and then Chrysler and Sunbeam as they made munitions and reconditioned the M4 Sherman tanks.
Now, I know there are a lot of bullets were made in Evansville during World War II, especially the 50 caliber.
Mm-hmm. 45 caliber.
45 caliber?
The 45 caliber, they made 3.2 billion rounds of that. And that was actually 96% of all the 45 caliber ammunition that was used in the war, basically in the Colt 1911 pistol and the Thompson submachine gun.
Now, the local industries seems like they were honored constantly by the government for their productivity.
Right. Were they
E-flags?
Right. The E-awards were awards that were given for efficiency and quality and quantity. And we actually had 15 companies that got that, and they got them 37 times. Only 3 to 5% of all the manufacturers would get an E-award, and just Evansville was lucrative in having a lot of capabilities that we turned over from, like you said, making refrigerators to making bullets or refurbishing tanks and things like that.
Now, the Evansville Shipyard, a sprawling place, I think at one time it had as many as 19,000 employees. They made, I think, 167 LSTs here in Evansville.
That's correct.
And they were cranking them out there once they got going.
It would take about 2 months, about 60 days, to build an LST from the keel all the way to where it was ready to go down the Ohio River and the Mississippi to go to war.
And the LST, of course, was in Normandy on D-Day.
Right.
Delivered
25 right.
troops and equipment. And then I think it also took back wounded and prisoners, too.
Yeah.
Correct. And it was used both in the European and the Pacific campaigns.
Mm-hmm. Now, the P-47 plant, the Republic Aviation, that also was, they put that together pretty quickly, too. I think they made over 6,000 planes there. Is that, Alan?
6,175.
Wow. And different models of planes, of P-47s.
Yeah, well, there were basically only two models, the Razorback and the Bubble Canopy.
Now, the Bubble Canopy, that was a game changer, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, because before the Bubble Canopy, the Razorback, you could turn your head side to side, and that's about as far as you could see, because it was all metal up to that point. And then when they came out with the Bubble Back, and this was after the pilots all complained that they couldn't see, Republic came out with a Bubble Canopy, and then you got your vision all the way around, because you could turn your head and see what was behind you, too.
Now, the material used in the bubble, was that made here in Evansville?
Right. Hoosier Cardinal developed Lucite, which was a special type of acrylic plastic that was not near as susceptible to cracks and damage as the glass canopy was.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you walk into the museum, I mean, you see the weapons of war, a lot of those, but also you see the machines that made the weapons. I think that's very interesting.
That's correct. We've completely refurbished some of the old, three in particular, the old machines that were used in the Republic Aviation plant. And then we've also got some machines that we're going to start working on that are from the Chrysler plant where they made munitions.
I think it's interesting, too, that during World War II, President Roosevelt made a visit to the Republic Aviation plant, and I drove through the plant to meet the workers.
Right, right.
So let's go back to the home front during World War II. Now, there was a difference. I know we were talking about this. There's a difference between the Red Cross canteen and the USOs. Can you explain that, Jeff?
Right. The Red Cross canteen was basically to service the men and women in the service that were going across country. Back in those days, it took like 4 days to get across the country. And we had 7 railroads in the city of Evansville that really made that important service for us to provide to them. So sometimes they would have time to get off the train for a couple hours. And when they did, they were treated like they were being taken care of by their mom or mm-hmm. their girlfriend or their sister. And the guys remembered that to the extent we've got copies of a lot of letters that were written back from people in Africa or Belgium or Holland or France about how well they were treated in the Red Cross canteen in Evansville, Indiana. And then the USO, the Red Cross canteen was totally integrated. It would serve anyone, race, color, creed, it didn't matter. And then the USO was it was segregated to where there was one for the blacks and one for the whites. And those two buildings are torn down now, but one of them, Carver Community Center and the old Civic Center and things like that. But the CNEI Railroad Station is the one that was torn down, and its 4 actual columns that were saved actually became the 4 Freedoms Monument here in Evansville.
Now, you actually have kind of a replica of a Red Cross canteen in the museum, which is very interesting.
That's correct. We served 1.6 million servicemen and women through that canteen, up to 3,500 meals a day. But it was more so than just those quantities that was important. It was how the women took care of the service people that came through.
Understand that Bob Dole, a former vice presidential and presidential candidate, was one of those soldiers who came through Evansville.
That's correct. Actually, he was in training down at Camp Breckenridge, and at the same time he was there, we've got a picture of him and Jackie Robinson and Joe Lewis in the same photograph. He won the Bronze Star, Bob Dole did, for action with the 10th Mountain Division in Italy, where he went back and saved his radio man, pulling him to safety, and then was hit. And that was just like 2 weeks before the war was over. But then he suffered. He was in and out of consciousness for like 3 years after that. But, 27-year senator, served his country in all kinds of capacities, but came through Evansville like millions of people did at that time.
Now, Alan Sanderson is with us. He's a World War II veteran who flew a P-47 during combat in World War II. So, Alan, how many P-47s are still flying, do you know?
As far as we know, there are six. There was five, and they pulled one out of the a lake over in Belgium in Austria and brought it back to the States and renovated it. And it's flying, so we have six that we know of.
We would love to have a P-47 here in Evansville.
Yes, we would.
But they're hard to come by and probably expensive to maintain and to fly. Well, now, Alan, some of your military memorabilia is in the museum, correct?
Yes, some of it.
What do you have in the museum there?
Oh, just pictures and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Through transferring around back and forth across the states with the company I was with, most of my uniforms went by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that's memorabilia.
Now, your plane was named the Lady Jane, is that right?
Yes. That was after my first wife.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, did all the pilots get a chance to name their own plane?
Yes, and most of them did. They had some pretty foxy names on some of them, but a lot of them were pretty good, too.
I bet. So tell us, what was it like to sit in the cockpit of the P-47?
Pretty nice.
It's just only had one pilot, right?
One pilot. It was pretty nice. It wasn't as cramped as you might think. It was plenty of room, lots of instrumentation, lots of everything. With all the bombs and the guns and so forth, why, you had a lot of things to think about. But it was a real great airplane.
Now, how long did it take, to taxi and take off? Was it powerful enough that you were off the ground pretty quickly?
Oh, yes. If we went out in a group, might be four in a flight, might be 12 in a flight, just depends. But we could taxi out and be in the air in 5 minutes.
Really?
Yeah.
Because some of the airfields, I guess, weren't in the greatest shape either, so we had to get off the ground.
Yeah, we had those metal runways.
Mm-hmm. Now, the P-47 flew, I think they flew along with the bombers, is that right? And then they went on individual missions? Or how did that work?
Initially, the 47 was actually supposed to do high escort work for the bombers. Well, they found out that it was a gas guzzler, and so it wasn't long until that was taken over by the P-51s as escort, and they turned this into low ground support and dive bombing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the reputation was made.
That you mentioned the P-51, I have a quote here from the ace, Francis Gabby Gabreski,
yep,
who had 28 kills, I think. He said, if you want to get the girl, fly a P-51. If you want to go home to that girl, strap into a P-47.
That's right.
Because they had, I guess, a lot more protection than the P-51. So did you take a lot of flak in your plane?
Yes, we had quite a bit of flak. Every time you went on a mission, you could expect ground fire. And the lower you got, the mission, as you went down to strafe or dive bomb, that's when you got the flak.
Mm-hmm.
So got a copy of a video that shows Alan getting out of his cockpit, walking across the wing of the plane, and looking at a hole that's about the size of a watermelon in the wing. And
that was the top side.
Uh-huh.
The bottom side was bigger than that.
So you appreciated the well-made P-47 jug.
Yes.
It probably saved a lot of pilots' lives.
It's a very durable airplane. Unlike the P-51, which everybody thought was a glamour plane, the P-51 was liquid-cooled. The 47 was air-cooled. The difference being that if you got one little tiny leak in the liquid-cooled, you're out of business. It's like your car. It frees up, and that's it. But I've seen the 47 come back with all kind of damage, and it still kept running because nothing cut it off.
Now, what were some of your targets on these missions, Alan?
Most of our targets were places where the Nazis had the planes, like their own air bases, canals where they could ship stuff, railroads. Railroads was a real prime target because as they went up through Italy, the Germans were repeating back up north. As they went north, we tried to cut them off and did a pretty good job. That was called strangle.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That was the name of it.
Now, did you have a lot of close calls?
Well, let's say enough.
Nothing, well, you're here.
Nothing too serious. I didn't get back.
That's good. That's good. Now, did you have to have oxygen when you flew the plane? Did you go up high enough for that?
Not on most of our missions. Now, if we stayed in escort work, we used it, but we didn't have it. We didn't use it for that.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you do the strafing and the bombing as well?
Yes. Yes.
Now, whatever happened to your aircraft, the Lady Jane? Do you know?
Well, as far as we know, from everything, well, Jeff even did a bunch of background checks on it. We think it probably was destroyed. We don't know. But it wasn't the same plane I started off with.
Mm-hmm.
The plane I started off with was Razorback, and the one I finished up flying was a bubble canopy.
I know a lot of the military hardware, I know like the LSTs after the war, other countries would get these weapons and ships and planes, and I'm sure some of them probably ended up in other air forces.
Yeah, unfortunately, we gave a bunch of them to France, and we gave a bunch to South America. And in South America, I think there's about three of them down there still flying, but they won't even talk to you about them.
Really? Darn it. Now, Jeff, we can't let you go without telling us about this bomb that became a doll. What's this all about?
Oh, yeah. There's a story actually came from one of our board members that when she was little, she was a little girl, and there's Boots Manufacturing used to make bombs in this area, or at least the housing for them. So about 3 foot tall bomb, and if it's sitting on its wing, I mean, it's sitting on its fins upright, she would take a little wig and put it on the bomb, and that would be her playmate for the day.
Okay.
So strange use of military equipment, but it worked to, you know, keep that little girl occupied.
Definitely. Well, still to come, we're going to continue our tour of the Evansville Wartime Museum, learn more about some of the exhibits, and hear about some exciting events on the calendar, including an upcoming trip to Normandy to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion. 2 Main Street is presented by Evansville Regional Airport. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. My guests are Jeff Dyg with the Evansville Wartime Museum and World War II veteran Alan Sanderson, who piloted a P-47 made at Republic Aviation in Evansville. Now, Jeff, there are 3 galleries at the museum, and it's the home front, main, and special gallery. Let's start with the special gallery.
Special gallery is where we have fun by trying to keep the museum fresh by bringing different subject matters in there. Right now, it's inhabited by World War I as a subject. But some days, you know, we might have something in there on the Civil War, or we might have something in there on Iraq and Afghanistan, or Vietnam, or Korea, or something like that. So it's an opportunity for us to do that. Right now, we've got 2 awesome displays that are in there. One deals with nurses from Evansville during World War I, and the other one features the James Bethel Gresham as a subject.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other galleries, you've got the home front. And of course, we're talking about that's where all the local industries are
manufacturing, right? That's where we talk about how things were done. And then we move into the main gallery, which shows a lot of those things that were made. And then the Heroes Gallery is where we talk about the people that were in service. And then the Community Gallery is where we talk about the Red Cross and the USO that we've already talked about.
Well, one of the people, of course, Major Alan Sanderson, and we were just talking about a special mission you had near Pisa, Italy. What happened, Alan?
Well, we were on a mission, usual mission, going up looking for targets. And we got up close to the northern part of Italy, and all of a sudden we getting a terrific amount of gunfire, 20-millimeter stuff breaking all around us. And so I got on the phone and on the radio, and I told my wingman, I said, "You guys hang tight. I'm going down to take that gun emplacement out. I see where it is. It's right at the base of that big white building." And all of a sudden, one of the other elements called in and said, "Sandy, I wouldn't do that. I think that's the Leaning Tower of Pisa."
So they strategically put their placement there, thinking that you guys wouldn't take them out. And you didn't.
But ironically, 3 days later, we were in the same area, and that's where I got the hole in the wing.
Oh, they did shoot him.
From those guys, probably.
Yeah.
Oh, my. Okay, well, of course, next year is the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion. A special tour is planned. And, Jeff, you're going to tell us about that in a moment. But first, Alan, where were you on Tuesday, June 6th, 1944?
I was on the island of Corsica, which is off of Italy, and we were flying close support. We didn't know anything about D-Day until that morning when we took off, and we flew missions all day long, and our missions were to hit the Germans behind as they retreated off of Normandy. So we had our missions were to kind of cut them off on the backside.
Mm-hmm. Who was your commander?
At that time?
Yes.
Well, General Cannon was the big man. Mm-hmm. Our particular man was...
Now, you had fighter wings and squadrons. How did that work?
We had a squadron. 64th was our squadron. We had three squadrons in each group. The 57th Fighter Group was the whole group in the 12th Air Force.
Mm-hmm. So did you have some characters in that group,
Sandy? Oh, yeah. There were always characters everywhere. We had people that would do things you wouldn't believe.
Well... Maybe you can share one of those with us. Okay. And just to remind our listeners of the enormity of the D-Day invasion, I found this description from Tom Brokaw in his book, The Greatest Generation. He says, there has never been a military operation remotely approaching the scale and the complexity of D-Day. It involved 167,000 troops, more than 12,000 airplanes, almost 10,000 ships, boats, landing craft, frigates, sloops, and other special combat vessels, all involved in a surprise attack on the heavily fortified north coast of France to secure a beachhead in the heart of enemy-held territory so that march to Germany could begin. It was daring, risky, confusing, bloody, and ultimately glorious. I think that's a great description of D-Day.
Yes, it is.
And what about this D-Day anniversary trip, Jeff?
Well, it's called the Memories of World War II, and it's actually put together by Colette, the big travel agency, and through lifestyle tours here in town. So we've got local representation. The EMSA Wartime Museum is actually hosting this tour. It'll be in the early part of August of 2019. And we're actually we're going to have a travel show on September 18th this year to give details about just what that tour is going to be all about. And so the general public is welcome to come to that. There's no cost in it and should be a great introduction to just how the tour is going to work. But it's of England and of France, and particularly the invasion beaches of Normandy.
And that cemetery near in Normandy.
Right, yeah. Right. The one near Utah Beach and Omaha Beach, mm-hmm. Where a gentleman from Altus McReynolds from Evansville, Indiana, is actually buried and won the Silver Star and the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart. He was a part of the 101st Airborne.
Really?
Yeah, he parachuted in on June 6th, was mortally wounded on June 7th, and then passed away on June 8th. But received the Silver Star for his actions.
Of course, the 101st Airborne Division out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, very decorated division. Now, you also have a hangar bash coming up. What's that all about?
Yeah, on October 13th, we've got a hangar bash. This is our second annual. It's a real fun event. It's catered, so we're going to have great food that day. We're going to have the Ohio Valley Microbrewers Association come in and give their support to it, and we'll have live music. Last year, we had over 200 people, and it sold out. So this year, we're going to find a way to where hopefully we can take up to 300 people and make that event something special. But it's a real fun time, and people of all ages and all backgrounds, a lot of veterans come to that, and it's just a fun time.
We're talking to Jeff Dyke with the Evansville Wartime Museum and Alan Sanderson, a World War II veteran who flew the P-47. And Alan, so what did you do after you got out of the service?
Well, I stayed in the reserves for the Air Force for about 3 years in Virginia. And then I got transferred around So I had to drop out because I couldn't leave my family in a strange town and take up reserve, too.
So were you involved at all in the Korean conflict?
No.
Okay. And what business did you go into then?
Went into the finance business. I was with American General, mm-hmm. which is long gone by now.
So what brought you to the Evansville area?
They transferred me here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you've been here ever since?
Since 58.
Wow. So what do you think of this museum, Alan?
It's beautiful. We've really had a lot of good volunteer work, and everybody's gone to work. Really, it's just amazing what they've done.
Well, I think it's very important to tell the story of Evansville's participation in World War II. I mean, a tremendous productivity, like we said, with the shipyard and all the munitions and the P-47 plant. I mean, of course, that's how you win a war. You got to have the material.
Right.
You've got the guys in the front lines, and they got to be supplied. So this is an important story to tell, and I know you guys enjoy relating that to the younger generation and the importance of doing that. And I know you have tours, and you bring students in. Is that right, Jeff?
Yeah, we have. We love it when we go to all the classrooms, all the history classrooms in Evansville-Vandenberg School Corporation, well, in Vandenberg, Warwick, and Posey counties. But we like it best when they, in a form of a field trip, turn our museum into their classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So that works out the best, and the kids tend to remember it longer. They ask really intelligent questions, as those that come from nursing homes.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not just any one age group. We're trying to take care of everybody because there's a lot of information out there that they just seem to be soaking up.
Mm-hmm. So your museum, I mean, you're adding items all the time. Mm-hmm. And where do you get these items?
They're just coming out of the woodwork. The more people hear about us, and most of the time when people come see it or somebody has come and seen it, then all of a sudden they'll come back, or they'll come for the first time and they'll have stuff with them, or they'll talk to us about stuff. But it's very critical that they see if it's, so they don't waste their time to see if it's something we can really use, because it might not be, or it might be something that we've got 50 of.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, people are putting their heart and soul into the subject by adding to the museum, but we can always use more volunteer efforts. So it's not just all about us needing financial help. We need volunteer support. And I think a lot of us that volunteer a lot of time, we do it because it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got a passion for the subject.
Yeah.
And I know you like to have people come and research, too. And I know you've got like a little library that's already formed.
Yeah, that's the intentions are, is one of our goals is to possibly have a reading room and stuff like that. We've got lots of books that have been donated. We need to organize those. Our curatorial services are pretty technical. And in order for us to make sure we keep track of everything that's being donated, we need to log each one of those books into a system so that we can then find them. We don't want to turn ourselves into a library where we check in and out books and things like that. But for people to sit in the atmosphere of war materials and war goods and things like that and be able to read about it, people were thinking that would be a real special entity for us to have inside our museum.
Well, I think it's very special, the fact that, Alan, you flew the P-47, and then you ended up in Evansville, the plant, and next to the plant that made the plane that you flew. Mm-hmm. How ironic is that?
That's true.
That's going to be great.
People used to ask me, said, did you know that when you were flying the 47, it was made in Evansville? I said, I didn't even know where Evansville was at that time.
And then here you are in the city that made your plane.
Yeah.
So that's got a great connection there, too. Now, also, the museum can be rented out for special events. Is that correct?
Right. We have a lot, a real variety of ways that people would like to use it. Some groups are having their board meetings there just as a special place. But we've had reunions. We've actually had a wedding there. Some people that met in an airport and figured that it would be appropriate and nice if they could get married in a hangar. We've had alumni organizations, church groups, scout groups, veterans groups, school field trips. I mean, people are just wrapping their arms around it and helping us out by showing their interest and wanting to add to what the museum can be for everybody of all ages.
Now, Alan, you've seen, I probably have seen some of these remaining P-47s that are still flying. Mm-hmm. How do they look?
Well, they look great. The ones that we've seen, they keep them up. Of course, they have to keep them up because there's no more of them left. But we keep following up to try to find one, even a shell for one. But so far, we haven't had much luck.
What about getting parts for those?
If you could scrounge around, give you a good example. They raised the one I told you about that was taken out of a lake in Australia. They brought it back and took it to Des Moines, Iowa, and renovated it completely, refurbished it, and rebuilt it, and we saw it fly. That was the number 6. And so what pieces they couldn't salvage, they managed to either make or find in a salvage yard somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Now, the pilots that fly these planes, how do they learn how to fly a P-47?
Well, they're usually the kind of guys that been flying everything in the world, and uh-huh. So they just get in one just like anybody else.
Well, there's probably still some manuals out there for this aircraft.
Oh, yeah.
And the specs, definitely. So what do you see for the museum in the next maybe 5 to 10 years, Jeff?
Well, it's interesting that you should ask that because we've got a long-range strategic planning committee that's really looking into that. We're starting out by saying, who are we now, and then what do we want to be? And we're really looking down the path of, where do we want to take this subject? And so it's not something that in a month you have all your answers. You know, this could be a process that would take 2 years to turn yourself into something that has a real future to it. But and I think the way we'll do that is by keeping the subject alive so that people don't come to the museum and say, well, I don't need to go back because I saw that 3 years ago. And so we've got some really class people of all different kinds of expertise and stuff like that are on our board and especially on the strategic planning committee about thinking about things like that. And it's a labor of love. So,
well, I think one of the things I noticed when I walked into the museum, I mean, I love those old vehicles that you have. Mm-hmm. And they have to be quite an attraction that people check those out.
Yep. We actually got the Old Time Auto Club is actually going to have an event and bring all their old cars to the museum for one of our special events that we have. Mm-hmm. But then we have things that are fun, and people come to those, like the Hangar Bash, et cetera. We've had alumni associations, like the retirees from Bucyrus Erie came out. The Reserve Officers Association came out and had a fantastic event with a guest speaker. So it's there's a lot of people. And then once they get a hold of it, that's one of the first questions they ask you, where are you going?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mayor even asked us that. Where are you going to take this thing? You know, he's real interested in what we're doing, as well as some of the other. We're great partners of all the other museums in the area. The last thing we wanted to be was try and become a competitor of them. We want to add to the reason why people want to come to Evansville, Indiana. Some of them will come to us just as their initial destination and see other things. Other people will come to Evansville for all the great things it has to offer, one of which would be the Evansville Wartime Museum.
Well, of course, we got the LST-325. The Vincennes has a military museum.
The Indiana Military Museum. Awesome. Been in existence for 20 years. If you haven't been there, people need to go to that, just like go to the LST. Mm-hmm. But they're great partners. We've actually been down to Camp Breckenridge. They've got a museum down there. We talked to a tour agency, Lifestyle Tours, about the possibility of having a motor coach tour that wrapped itself around and have it be one night over, but would tour those four museums whose subject matter is basically around World War II and military history.
Well, you could go to Fort Knox as well. That's not that far away.
Yeah, that's true.
Of course, so, the Armored Museum there.
Yeah. And Patton Museum of
Armor. Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So things like that are just fun to brainstorm about and say, how can we make this happen? And people jump on board really quick.
Mm-hmm. Alan Sanderson is here, World War II veteran who flew the P-47 and on a number of combat missions. Okay, when the war ended, Alan, where were you at when the peace was signed?
in May of 45.
Were you still overseas?
Or were you going
I was back home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In May of 45, I was still in reserve.
Mm-hmm. So did you guys celebrate?
Well, actually, I guess I was. Yeah, I was just before getting out.
Mm-hmm.
I was discharged in, I think, late 46.
Now, when you say you were discharged, can you only fly so many combat missions, and then they?
No. We depending on the theater of war that you were in, like in England, they flew pretty long missions, 8-10 hours in the bombers, and they only flew 25, sometimes 50 missions, depending on. We didn't have any particular number that we flew.
Mm-hmm.
The flight surgeon just took good observation. When he decided you had enough, he said, you want to go home.
And you said, okay, I'll go. Now, the P-47s also flew in the Pacific Theater.
Right, not as much because the island hopping was a gas hog.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But one of the things, Alan, after VE Day, you were actually on your way to the Pacific and going to have to fight over there.
Our group was, group was, and I was probably going to join them back because I was home on leave. And they got as far as the canal. They shipped them out of Italy, and they got as far as the canal, and the war was over, so they turned around and came back to New York.
So would you still fly the P-47s then, or would they put you in a different aircraft?
No, we'd have been in 47s.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, those long distances between the islands there in the Pacific, you wouldn't have enough gas to get back.
47 had a good record out there, though. They did pretty well.
Mm-hmm. So they were involved in the island hopping and taking out the Japanese positions? And
they did a lot of escort work out there.
Okay, that's right.
Yeah, like, you know, if you were on Saipan, then you could help with the conflict on Tinian because it was right next door.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if the air base was operational on Saipan, then you could do bombing and strafing on Tinian.
So, as long as I got you here, Alan, what about any aerial combat? Did you have to battle any Messerschmitts or?
No, we didn't. We didn't see too much of them in the air. We saw more of them on the ground than anyplace else. And of course, that was our objective, was to keep them on the ground. But the funniest incident we had was when the Germans first came out with jets.
Mm-hmm.
We saw them on two occasions, and they went straight up through our formation, right straight up from the bottom, and disappeared. And that's the only time we saw the jets.
So they didn't come back?
No.
Wow. Well, that had to be something.
But we did have some people that got into, especially in the earlier part of Italy, when we were in the southern part of Italy, we were flying over the Adriatic, which was over into Yugoslavia. And then at that time, some of the guys did have some combat with ME-109s and, Messerschmitts, whatever. But they did real well with them, too. They shot them all down. We never lost but one plane to the enemy by aerial combat, and that was over the Adriatic.
Really?
Yeah.
That's an incredible record.
We lost planes other than that, maybe getting too close to the ground or maybe an ammo dump that you were strafing blew up in your face or something like that. But as far as air, we didn't lose anybody to the Germans.
Well, Jeff, I tell you, this museum, I know it's a passion of yours, and you have to have a passion for it to put all the time you do into it. So what got you involved in this project?
Well, I've been interested in history since I was a kid, and out of respect for my father, he was in the Marines in the Pacific and wounded twice on Saipan. Out of dedication and support of him and respect, I got a strong interest in World War II in particular. But then I started getting interested in what Evansville did and the LST. When it came, that fired me up. And then when this guy sitting next to me, when I met him, just so much respect for him, and just a personal friend. We about what they went through back then, but then what the people here at home went through, so the army at home could support the armies abroad. I've just always loved where I live and feel blessed to live here. But a lot of those same ideas and thoughts and method of living and way of taking care of each other still exist today. And so that's how I got interested in it. And then they complimented me by asking me to be on the board. And it could be a full-time job if I let it.
Well, I know you got a lot of great people on that board, mm-hmm. and they all share that passion that you have. And we have a lot of great researchers in town, too, that right. Have really done a lot of work on Evansville's history during the war. James McLeod, I know. You have his book, I think, at the museum.
Right. Mark Browning, Harold Morgan. They're all great people. And then people that go out and preach the sermon. That talk to the schools and get the school. They've really been creative in their medium that they use to deliver and get the kids interested. And then the kids end up bringing the parents to the museum.
Really?
So it's pretty awesome the way that thing grows. We've talked to genealogical and historical societies. We talked to one the other night that was out of town. They want to bring a bus to Evansville, come through our museum, and eat at the Greyhound bus station. So I thought that was pretty cool, a spinoff of one of our little side trips that was down in Madisonville.
Well, you're talking about the bus station. Of course, prior to the bus station, the L&N Depot was the spot in Evansville.
Right. 7 railroads came through Evansville.
That's amazing.
That's what made the Red Cross Canteen so needed.
Well, that would be a 24/7 place,
it was.
L&N Depot.
Yeah, it was. And, just the hustle and bustle of that. And going through all the CNEI railroad, a lot of things. And a lot of material was coming through town that didn't have people. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things I found very interesting, that the tanks had to be shipped back to Evansville to be reinforced because they were getting clobbered by the Panzers.
Right. And they were being worn out in training here in town. They would just run them till they wouldn't run anymore, and then they had to be reconditioned. And that's why we reconditioned almost 1,700 of them during the war. But the M4 Sherman tank was nicknamed after a Ronson, after the lighter. And if I'm riding around a tank, I don't want that to be my nickname, because mm-hmm. that means it was easy to catch on fire.
Right. Mm-hmm. Did you target tanks when you were over there, Alan?
Oh, yes. Yeah, tanks and locomotives.
So were you successful?
Oh, yeah. We had pretty good success with locomotives because it was like getting a direct hit on something really important if you knocked a locomotive out, because that did all the transportation in.
Well, they were transporting supplies and troops, and they had to repair the tracks afterwards, so that was a big deal.
Well, they didn't have the locomotive to repair. All shot.
Wow. Well, Alan, I wanted to let you know that my mom worked at Republic Aviation mm-hmm. assembling the P-47s. Now, she died a few years ago, but she would always speak fondly of the hard work on the line there at Republic and the pride of all the workers that they felt in building a solid, safe aircraft for pilots like you. Now, she rode the bus from Vincennes 6 days a week to work at the plant. Mm-hmm. She was like 19 years old, I think, or 20. And when the war ended, she married my dad, who served overseas in the Army for 3 years. Wow. He landed on Omaha Beach. He fought in the Battle of the Bulge. And it has been a privilege to talk to you, Alan. You are a member of the greatest generation, and we're so fortunate to have you here on 2 Main Street. And Jeff Dieg, thanks for keeping the memory of the greatest generation alive at the Evansville Wartime Museum. You've got to check it out. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, presented by Evansville Regional Airport. Major Alan Sandy Sanderson, who is now in his mid-90s, flew 118 combat missions in the European Theater of Operations. His 64th Fighter Squadron was known as the Black Scorpions. In the book Famous Fighters of the Second World War, the P-47 Thunderbolts are credited with dropping 132,000 tons of bombs and firing 135 million rounds of ammunition and 60,000 rockets at the enemy. And 2/3 of all Thunderbolts produced reached overseas combat commands. The Evansville Wartime Museum is located on Petersburg Road, just off Highway 41. It's open during weekends, Saturday from 10 to 4 and Sunday from noon to 4. You can keep up with events at the museum by going to the Evansville Wartime Museum Facebook page. On the next two Main Street, we go inside Hangers. That's the clothing bank for students in the Evansville-Vandenberg school system. And we find out the students receive much more than just slacks, shirts, and shoes. Two Main Street is presented by Evansville Regional Airport. Two Main Street on 88.3 WNIN-FM airs Thursday at noon and Saturday at 11. And our interviews are also online at WNIN.org.